Any other questions, folks? We have a minute or two before we actually start the class.
Professor, I do have a question. If my regression for B, for example, is throwing a negative beta coefficient, should I just like choose another ratio, or is my regression?
Yeah, you're going to have that problem with multiple linearity. Don't worry about it. Just leave the beta. Is the t-statistic still, is there still statistical significance of the beta with a positive coefficient?
I guess so, yeah.
Then it's okay, you can leave it in. It's a predictive power of the regression doesn't suffer. What suffers is how you read the coefficients. As long as you're not reading too much into the individual coefficients, just leave them as is.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, folks, welcome back. And I hope you've had a good couple of days. So I want to continue with what we started last session. We were talking about valuing private companies. And I talked about the two big issues you're going to run into. One is the absence of a market value for your company. You know, you're going to run into this in multiple places. So a few of you are actually valuing private companies as your project. And you've run into the fact that when you do your cost of capital, there's no market value of equity to get the debt ratio. When you finish valuing the company, there's no market value to check it against. And obviously, there's no beta regression you can run for your company. So today, I want to talk about valuing private companies. And I said in the last session that the way you value a private company will depend on context. Are you valuing a private company for sale to another private individual? Are you valuing a private company for a sale to a public company? Are you valuing a private company for an IPO? And you can actually get different numbers with each one. So let's start by taking a very simple example. Let's assume that you're trying to value a French restaurant. It's an upscale French restaurant. The owner says, look, I want to sell the restaurant. He's got financials for 3 years. And the potential buyer of the restaurant is a former investment banker who's going to take his entire savings and buy this restaurant. So I've set up the game. So you've got a seller who's a chef and the buyer who's a banker. And the banker is going to take all his savings and buy the restaurant. So here's what the last 3 years of financials look like for the company. Let me actually convert to full slide form so everybody can see properly. Here's what the financials look like for the company. So basically, the chef gives you the last 3 years. There's the most recent year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Obviously, the restaurant is seeing growing revenues, but the chef is pretty honest. He says, look, we're operating at full capacity. We can't really go much beyond this. If you're going to have growth, it's going to be fairly limited because going forward, you just have to fill up every chair and we're already there. The chef has followed the old accounting rules, which allowed you to subtract out lease expenses. So why should it be any different? He's subtracting out the lease expense. He has wages, material, but he mentioned that, but you ask him, do you pay yourself a salary? And the chef says, I own the restaurant. Why would I pay myself? So the 200,000 you see as wages does not include a salary for the chef. Keep that in mind, because when you value this restaurant, that's going to come into play. Overall, though, this restaurant has operating income of 400,000 and net income of 240,000. So that's what the restaurant made last year. Your job is to assess the value for this restaurant for sale to another private individual. So let's take the first step in the process. To do a discounted cash flow valuation, you need a discount rate. And everything we've done so far has been built on valuing public companies. So public companies, we make this very convenient assumption. The assumption that the marginal investor is diversified. And what does it allow us to do? It allows us to focus only on the risk that cannot be diversified away and use a beta to capture the cost of equity. Big assumption, but we make them fairly cavalierly with public companies. In a private company, that assumption is definitely going to break down, especially in the context that I've just described. Why? Because the potential buyer is not going to be diversified. To use beta to come up with the cost of equity for that valuation makes no sense. So from that context, one of the first challenges I will face is coming up with a cost of equity for a transaction where the buyer is not going to be diversified. So let me give you a very simple way in which you can get around the problem. Let's start with the fact that you can get a market beta from publicly traded restaurants. Let's say that market beta is 0.86. But before I go any further, if you look at publicly traded restaurants in the US, you're going to see Chipotle, Applebee's, McDonald's, and this is an upscale French restaurant. So you could actually argue that maybe the beta you're getting from restaurants is not, remember we talked about discretionary, non-discretionary? that this is a very discretionary, you know, choice. So basically, instead of using the beta for publicly traded restaurants, I'm going to use the beta for high-end retailers. You see, are you allowed to do that? Remember, in valuation, you get a lot of room to make judgment calls, and I'm making a judgment call. The unlevered beta for high-end retailers is 1.18. You say, but this is a private for private transaction. Hang in there. This is the beta that I'm getting by looking at high-end retailers. Now, here's the part where it gets tricky. If this were a public company, all we focus on is market risk. So let me give you a very simple picture of what I'm talking about. Let's assume you have a firm with 100 units of risk, right? Let's say 20 units of risk are market risk. This is risk coming from macroeconomic variables. 80 units are firm specific. When you have a valuation of a publicly traded company, all you focus on are the 20 units of market risk. You measure those 20 units with a market beta and use that market beta to come up with the cost of equity. That's how we've got cost of equity so far. But in this particular case, think of what's going to happen. The buyer is going to be exposed not just to the 20 units of risk, but also to the extra 80 units of firm-specific risk. Intuitively, if your investor is not diversified, the buyer is not diversified, he or she is going to see far more risk in your company than a diversified investor and will demand a cost of equity to cover the total risk. So when I first ran into this issue in the early 90s, I remember asking private company appraisers how they dealt with this problem, that buyers were not diversified, but all the information that they had came from public companies. They said, how do we come up with the cost of equity for private companies? And the response I got was, we take risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium, and then we add 10%. And I said, why 10%? This was here when I got here. Basically, the response was, there's no good reason. I'm just adding 10% because I need a higher cost of equity. In fact, that still remains the standard practice in private company valuation. It's called the build-up approach. It's a little more finesse now. So here's what they do. They take the risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium. Then they'll add a small cap premium and a company-specific risk premium. Basically, their job is to push up the cost of equity. But that doesn't work for me. That really makes no sense to me. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm actually going to use the information I have in public companies to extract the cost of equity to an undiversified investor. You're saying, how the heck are you going to do that? Remember that regression you get the beta from? That regression also gives me information about how much of the risk in my stock is market risk, right? In the R squared. If you remember the Bloomberg beta regression, there's a raw beta, that's a market beta, and below that it's an R-squared. You see, what's an R-squared? The R-squared tells you the proportion of risk in your stock that comes from the market. So if I can get the beta for high-end retailers, I can also see how much of the risk in a typical high-end retailer comes from the market by looking at the R-squareds of these stocks. And I did that. And here's what I found. I found an average R-squared of 0.25. Now, this is a little bit of statistical geekology, but beta is a standard deviation measure. R squared looks at variance. So when I want to convert, when I want to use betas in R squared, I've got to look at the square root of R squared, which obviously is R, or the correlation coefficient. The first edition of the book of Applied Corporate Finance, where I developed this, I call this a total beta, I developed the total beta approach. I actually screwed up. I'd use the R squared in the denominator until somebody pointed it out. So here's what I'm going to do. Think of it as an algebra problem. If you're a diversified investor looking at a high-end retailer, the beta you would see is 1.18. But if you're an undiversified investor looking at exactly the same business, you're going to see that beta. But remember, only half the risk in this stock is market risk. You're going to say, look, I want to be rewarded for the remaining half. So if you think in terms of an algebra problem, I'm just scaling up the beta to capture the 80 units of firm-specific risk. And that total beta is what I'm going to use in my cost of equity. Before I plow on, are there any questions about the intuition behind what I'm trying to do and what the end result of this is going to be? So the total beta measures the risk from the perspective of an undiversified investor. It's obviously going to be much higher than my market beta. And now comes a step where I again run into trouble. Normally, when you get an unlevered beta for a public company, to convert it to a levered beta, you use a debt to equity ratio, right? That debt to equity ratio should be a market debt to equity ratio. Now, you can dance all you want with a private company, but there is no market equity. So I know there are analysts who use book debt to equity. Please don't do that. The one number you cannot use is a book debt to equity. But you're saying, I don't have a market debt to equity. You have a couple of choices. One is you can use the average market debt to equity of publicly traded companies in the space, saying if that is the typical leverage that a company in the restaurant or the retail business has to carry, I'm going to assume my company is stuck with that same debt to equity. The second choice, and this is a little trickier, is use the circular reasoning, the iteration function in Excel, and you actually use your estimated value of equity as the equity in the debt. I know it sounds incredibly messy, but it's doable. In Excel, you can actually use your own estimated value of equity. And the reason you have to check the iteration box is there'll be circularity, but it still works. So either way, here's what you're gonna end up. You have the unlevered beta of 2.36. The debt to equity ratio I chose to use for this restaurant was the average debt to equity for publicly traded restaurants. So it's 14.33%. I came up with a levered total beta of 2.56. So here's my cost of equity. At the time that I valued this restaurant, the T-bond rate was 4.25%. There's my levered rate of 2.456. And my equity risk premium at the time that I did this, very different time, was 4%. Risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium gives me a cost of equity of 14.5%. That is going to become the cost of equity I use to value this private company. Darshan?
Now, 14.33% includes leases?
It includes leases, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so just we have to be consistent because I am going to treat leases as debt for this restaurant as well.
No, it looked lower in because of...
this is a different time. Market caps are higher since, I think, 2007 maybe. Now, today, if you did this, my guess is going to be 30 or 40% at least across restaurants, maybe even higher. No. Julieta?
Yeah, I have another question. So you're using the unlevered beta of the high-end retail, but then you're using the debt to equity of the restaurant?
Yeah, because I'm making two different arguments, right? One is when I'm talking about unlevered beta, I'm talking about how discretionary is your product or service, and I'm going to go to the unlevered beta of restaurants for that. But unlevered beta of retailers for that. But here, because this is a restaurant, the way you borrow money is being driven by the fact that you've got to lease the premises. So I'm using the restaurant debt equity. I'll be quite honest, if I'd used the retailer debt equity, I'd have got pretty much the same answer then. So that was just tricky in this case because I was making a different judgment call. But there is a little bit of an inconsistency, but I can live with that.
Thanks.
Okay.
Professor,
Derek? Go ahead, Shashanka Prairie.
Yeah. So when you are scaling up the beta, you are essentially extrapolating the market risk. But different companies would have different individual company risk. All right.
Yeah, but I'm saying, but if you're a diversified investor, what ends up happening is you set a price per risk based per unit of risk. So all I'm doing is taking the price per risk that I get from public markets. And I'm saying you're an undiversified investor. You are, in fact, bringing in this total beta brings in the company-specific risk. The difference between what I'm doing and what the private company practitioners are doing is they just assume a constant. Company-specific risk premium is an extra 5%. I'm arguing that that's going to be different for different companies. Let me give you a limiting example. Let's suppose your private company is an incredibly diversified company in 50 businesses. There's going to be very little company-specific risk in it, right? Mm. So when I do the total beta calculation, the adjustment I'm going to make to your beta is going to be very small because the R-squared is already 90%. So this is actually just a way of bringing in company-specific risk that takes into account differences across sectors. In fact, I have a total beta. You know, if you go to my data, just as you can look up betas per sector, right, you can look up total betas per sector, where I bring in the R-squareds for every sector. So I've got my cost of equity. Perry, do you have a question? You're okay.
I'm good.
Okay. Now let's complete this process. Yeah, go ahead.
So what if there's a private company which is diversified in its businesses in that sense, like it has 10 lines of businesses, but
then the R squared would start to rise towards one, right? So if you're a family group and all your companies are privately held and you're in 25 different businesses, your R squared is very quickly going to start to move towards one. So it'll take care of itself, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about the cost of debt and the cost of capital. To get the cost of debt, I look for a bond rating in what's a privately owned small restaurant. There was no bond rating. So I use the interest coverage ratio. So you can already see much of what I've done with public companies was designed to be flexible enough that I could do this for a private company. I took the interest coverage ratio, which is 3.33. And because I'm treating leases as debt, I'm including lease expense as a financial expense. That gives me a rating of BB+ and a default spread of 3.25%. You add that to the risk-free rate, I've got my pre-tax cost of debt of 7.5%. Again, don't fall back on, I don't have a rating, therefore I'm going to use the book interest rate. You still have to try to get a rate at which you can borrow money long-term today. The marginal tax rate when I did this in the US was 40%, giving me an after-tax cost of debt of 4.5%. I'm home free. I've got my total beta cost of equity. I've got my synthetic rating driven cost of debt. My weights are still the industry average weights. Remember, it's $14.33 of debt for every $100 of equity. So that's my debt to cap ratio. So my overall cost of capital that I'm getting for this restaurant is about 13.25%. Much higher than it would have been if they'd been a publicly traded restaurant. But that's one of the penalties you face when the buyer is not diversified. They're going to demand a higher cost of equity. Okay. So now I can visit the financials. To take a look at the financials, I started with what the chef gave me. Those are the numbers the chef gave me, and I made some adjustments. One was a pretty standard one. Remember, we said lease expense is really not an operating expense. Just like for every other company, I made that correction here as well. I took lease expenses out and capitalized leases, treated it as debt. I made the big change, though, was in my wages. I put aside another $150,000 to hire a chef. Because here's what. You're the investment banker. You can't cook a lick. You buy this restaurant for whatever based on the stated operating income. The day after you buy the restaurant, you go to the kitchen and say, well, who's cooking dinner today? You know what the answer is going to be? You are. Well, good luck with that. So I'm actually hiring a chef, and that's something with private companies you always have to check. Do your wages include a salary expense? And if you don't have a salary expense, you got to find out what the owner does in the company. In many private businesses, you know what the owner does? He does everything. He's the cashier, he's the accountant, he's the inventory keeper, he's the quality control manager. Basically, he has seven different roles, and you got to hire probably two people to do what he does and set aside enough money to cover. The interest expense now includes the interest expense that I have in leases. So that's a natural consequence of taking the present value leases. My adjusted operating income with these changes is about $370,000. So any questions here? So the adjustment I'm making to the income, the primary adjustment is bringing in the chef salary and capitalizing leases. Capitalizing leases you'd have done anyway. To bring in the chef salary is very specific to private companies. Okay. Gabe, did you say that you don't want the EBITDA to be lower? No. And yeah, absolutely. You're going to pump up everything to make it look like you have whatever metric people are latching on to. You want that number to be high, whether it's net income, EBITDA, or EBIT. So that's why when you're the buyer, you've got to do your due diligence. You can't take whatever the seller has as next. Okay, I'm good with that. Now, it's not a question of honesty. It's a question of different perspectives.
So what if the chef was really a renowned chef? And I mean, do we need to adjust cash flows for?
Yeah, that's what we're going to do. That's what we're going to do next.
Yeah.
Okay. That's actually a good point. If the chef is, I know, I was going to say Chef Boyardee, but that's the first name that came across, and he's not even a chef. It's just a name on a can. No, but you could pick your favorite chef show and make that chef your chef. But here's the issue that Darshan is raising, which is you're buying a restaurant with a chef. The chef leaves after he sells the restaurant. And he told you the restaurant is packed, right? That's what the revenues were based on. The question is, will that still be true after you buy the restaurant? So you have to adjust for that. That's called a key person discount. And with any service-driven business where the owner leaves, the revenues to be affected, this is an adjustment you'll have to make. Now, how much of an adjustment will depend on how significant that the owner has been in drumming up business. If it's all personality-driven, 80% of your revenues could leave with that person. If it's, you know, the restaurant has a great location, it's got a good reputation, the chef is kind of a side story, the effect might be much smaller. I would love to tell you that there's some mathematical way of estimating what this is, but in this case, I've assumed that 20% of my revenues will be gone. Maybe I just stand outside the restaurant and ask if the big name guy who's running this restaurant leaves, will you come back to the restaurant? And maybe that survey leads you to come up with the 20%. So here's what I did. I took the $370,000 operating income and reduced it by 20%, saying if the chef leaves, I lose 20%. You can already see why this is going to become a big issue in value, because that 20% drop in operating income will reduce the value of the restaurant. So I remember about 15 years ago, the dentist for my kids, if you have kids or when, and if those of you don't have kids, when you have kids, you're going to realize that they're a cash flow problem. I mean, every year, negative cash. I love my kids, but they're negative cash flows. And one of those negative cash flows comes from braces. The great business to be in as a dentist is not only do you fit the braces and get paid once, you got to go back every month to get your braces tightened. So I would sometimes take my kids to the dentist and he'd always ask me finance and investing questions. And I'd usually answer. So one day I walk in and the guy says, I'm planning to sell my practice. And I said, that's nice. You're only 45. And he said, oh, I made a lot of money. And I almost said, I know, I've been paying some of those bills you sent me. And he was actually negotiating a sale to another dentist. And it turned out that the other dentist was offering him far less than he thought he should make, given the income he was making. So he asked me, what's going on? Why is this guy off? And I said, I said, the guy has a point. I mean, when he buys your dental practice, he's got to take into account the fact that there's a personality issue, which is if you leave, many of your clients, those young kids, will probably go somewhere else. So they're reducing. And he said, what can I do to reduce the impact? You know, and I gave him a suggestion, which is actually very commonly practiced in both medical and dental practices. You know what my advice was? What should he do to reduce the impact and value from the key person? Darshan?
Non-compete.
One was the non-compete is an obvious one, you know, which he was willing to do. Keep
the brand name and have like one or two visiting hours in a week.
In fact, that's what he ended up doing. He ended up selling the practice and agreeing to stay on for a year afterwards. He had an office. He did nothing, but he'd come out every time one of his little patients came in. He'd come out and say, look, you know, this is Joe, your new dentist, and he'd kind of get it. So he stayed on, not because he wanted to, but because that was the only way he could reduce the key person discount. So the non-compete clause is an obvious one. You definitely should get a non-compete clause because the last thing you want to do is buy this restaurant and have the chef open the restaurant next door. The second, though, is there might be some degree of overlap you want to build in so you don't reduce your value too much. It's in the interest of both the buyer and the seller. Nathaniel asked, could you discount the wages to it? No, you could. I mean, you could ask how much would you need to pay for a chef of equivalent name. That might work in a restaurant. No. But I think it's easier sometimes to just make that judgment call on the operating income. Any questions on the key person discount? Yeah, let me ask you a question. If Disney buys Tesla, Disney doesn't have the money to buy Tesla, forget about it. If Apple buys Tesla, would there be an Elon Musk discount, an Elon Musk premium, assuming Elon Musk leaves when they buy Tesla? I'll leave you to think about it because I think it's kind of a loaded call depending on what you think about Elon Musk. But my point is, this is not just with private company. There are some public companies where a person is so much a part of the company. You know, Martha Stewart goes to jail on insider trading. What happens to Martha Stewart Living? I leave it at the, you can actually go back and look at what happened to Martha Stewart Living when it happened. But it's something that even with public companies can become an issue.
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs. But Steve Jobs, in a sense, with, by the time he left Apple, I mean, you know, by the time he, you know, he moved away from the CEO position, had made himself, and this, I give Steve Jobs credit. He was a personality, but at the same time, he built a management team and he built a company that is sent. That's your job, actually, if you're a founder of a company, is you want to make yourself dispensable. I mean, I've always hated Microsoft with a passion because I'm an Apple user. But I have to tell you, I admire the way Bill Gates extricated himself from that company, made himself dispensable to the point where he could leave the company and walk away. And people were completely okay with it. That's, to me, that's part of being a great founder CEO, is creating that transition so that when you leave, the company doesn't fall apart. Okay. Now let's wrap up the loop. So we've got our discount rate, we've got our cash flows. And as I said, this is now a mature restaurant. You're filling up every chair. You're not going to have a high growth period. You need to figure out, though, how much you need to reinvest. You're saying, why do I need to reinvest? Your restaurant needs new kitchen equipment. So the reinvestment year will be whatever physical and capital equipment you got to invest in. And you can't forget the rules and valuation just because you're valuing a private company. How much will the restaurant need to reinvest? Well, let's assume that the restaurant is right now earning a 20% return on capital, which you should be able to compute for a private company because it's operating income and book value of debt, equity, and invested capital, all of which you should have for a private company. If you, I've given them a 2% growth rate in perpetuity, pretty close to the inflation rate at the time that I did the valuation, which effectively gives me a reinvestment rate of 10%, growth rate divided by return on capital. That's how I compute reinvestment rate for a public company. So the reinvestment rate you're going to see in my valuation is going to be 10%. Julian, can you unmute, you know, if you can unmute yourself and ask the question because it's a little long and I can't even read the question.
What's your question again? So assuming we don't mitigate the key person risk, doesn't that
mean- Are you the seller or the buyer?
I assume we're doing this all from the buyer's perspective.
Okay, so you can't mitigate. So the seller is going to sell and leave. So, and you're worried about how much your revenues will drop and leave.
So we're giving a haircut on the operating income.
Right.
So doesn't that mean our cost of debt needs to be recalculated?
Yeah.
The new, okay.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So when I compute my interest coverage ratio, you're right. I didn't even think about it. I should go back and do my interest coverage ratio all over again. And I think I might have in the actual calculation. I'll send you the Excel spreadsheet with the restaurant. No, but I'm not sure. But that's a good point. Yeah. So let's finish the valuation. So here's what I had as my numbers. 296,000. That's a key person adjusted operating income. 40% tax rate. 13.25% cost of capital. Reflecting the fact that I'm using a total data, 2% growth rate, 10% reinvestment rate. So I plug the numbers in, 296,000 times 1 minus the tax rate. I want next year's cash flow, so that's a 1 plus G. 1 minus 0.10 is, you know, net of reinvestment. So I'm just doing a shortcut what my free cash flow of the firm is. So if you don't like the way I've done it, just do the full free cash flow of the firm. Divided by cost of capital minus growth, give me a value for the restaurant of 1.449 million. That's the value of the entire restaurant. But remember, I capitalized the leases. And the debt value of the leases is 928,000. You subtract that out from the value of the restaurant, the value of what you would pay for the equity in this restaurant, which is what you're getting from the chef, is 521,000. Any question? I threw a lot of mechanics in there, but basically all I'm doing is taking expected free cash flow of the firm next year divided by R minus G. If this were a high growth restaurant, you'd use a two-stage. I mean, once you get the numbers, the process of valuation is exactly the same as with a public company. Any questions on the 521,000? Now comes a final step, which we never had to deal with public companies. You're the investment banker. You buy this restaurant for 521,000. Let's say, have you ever had buyer's remorse on an investment? You know what I mean? You buy 1,000 shares of stock. Oh my God, what did I do? And you sell it a minute later. The cost of buyer's remorse, the public company, is basically that you might have a bid-ask spread, even if the price hasn't changed. So, but there, my point is there's always an illiquidity issue. Public companies, it takes the form of a bid-ask spread. That spread, of course, is tiny for a liquid company, you know, big company like Apple, but it could be pretty large for a NASDAQ stock that's likely trade. With a private business, that illiquidity problem gets magnified. Here's why. Let's say you're the banker, you buy this restaurant for $521,000. 2 weeks later, you realize you made a horrific mistake. You're never meant to run a restaurant. This is actually more work than doing spreadsheets at a bank. So you try to sell the restaurant. Do you see how much more difficult it's going to be to reverse your action? So here's what happens in private company valuations. The buyer preemptively reduces the value he or she pays for the fact that they might not be able to sell in the future. You're saying, that's backwards. You're just buying. Why are you even thinking about selling right now? I've got to build it in at the time that I buy. That's called an illiquidity discount. Now, I talk about how private company appraisers come up with a number. But let me state what I think are pretty intuitive aspects about the illiquidity discount. The illiquidity discount should vary across private companies. So even if I'm looking at 20 private companies, it can't be the same for every one of them. And here's why. Healthier private companies should have smaller discounts than companies, private companies in trouble. Larger private companies should have a smaller percentage discount than smaller companies. Companies earlier in the life cycle should have larger discounts than more mature companies. So the first, it should vary across companies. Second, it should vary across time. What do I mean by that? If you've been trying to sell your private business early this year, let's say January 2020, you might have been able to settle for a 15% discount for liquidity. Can you imagine trying to sell that same business today in the midst of a crisis? My guess is people are going to be discounting your value like crazy. The amount of the discount should vary across time, increasing during crises and decreasing in good times. So it should vary across companies, vary across time. And finally, it should vary across buyers. Why? Because if I'm a buyer who really has no need for cash with a very long time horizon, somebody like Berkshire Hathaway, I care a lot less about liquidity than somebody who doesn't know what his cash flow needs will be next year. So it should vary across companies, vary across time, vary across buyers. I think of all the things I do in valuation, attaching an illiquidity discount still gives me the most headaches because it is so transaction specific. Do you see what I mean by transaction specific? You ask me, how much of a discount should I apply my value? I'm gonna ask you, who's your buyer? You know, what does the market look like? What does the company look like? Because I can't answer the question without getting information on all three aspects. So let's talk about how.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
Adam? Yeah. Under the category of buyers, would a buyer's access to the market to be able to resell difference mm-hmm. make a difference?
Absolutely.
Meaning the difference like a random neighbor buying the restaurant versus a private equity firm that has a network of potential buyers.
But that's tied to how, to the time, right? A private equity investor in a good market obviously can raise capital. A private equity investor today is going to have a huge amount of trouble, right? So you're right, the buyer's access to capital matters, but that buyer's access to capital varies across time. It's not a constant, but it is a factor, obviously.
Thank you.
Okay. So now let's talk about how practitioners deal with this. So for a long time, again, I'm good friends with Shannon Pratt. Shannon Pratt actually invented, I mean, he's actually the guru of private company valuation. His book is often used in private company valuation. So Shannon and I go back a long time. And one of the issues where Shannon and I disagree is he's actually been one of the people who's pushed an illiquidity discount as a concept. So our practitioners, who if you ask them how much do you attach as a discount, they're 20 to 25% for every company they buy. And that makes no sense to me. But the 20 to 25% thing, where did they come up with that 20 to 25%. I'll give away the secret. The 20 to 25% that you see practitioners use comes from studies of two groups of companies. One are companies with what are called restricted stock. These are companies that issue shares to the public, but these are restricted shares. The shares cannot be traded. So they're public companies that issue shares, but the shares, that they issue in the restricted stock offering cannot be traded. So what you can observe in these companies is the market price on their shares as well as the market price on the restricted shares. In a sense, you're getting a measure of how much your investor is demanding for liquidity. So the first group of studies look at companies that issue restricted stock. The second group of studies look at transactions that happen just before an IPO. You know what I mean by that? Let's say you have three VCs in a company and the company's planning to go public 3 months from now. Sometimes one of the VCs decides to sell his stake to another VC just before the public offer. You can observe the price at which this transaction happens and compare it to the IPO price. Another measure of, hey, how much did that VC get for liquidity? Now I'm going to argue that both of these types of studies are hopelessly flawed. But before I do that, in both studies, what people are observing is the price without, you know, the public market price versus the price that an investor is getting who wants liquidity right away. So that's why people like these studies. So let's start with the restricted stock discount. I mean, these discounts, the studies of restricted stock go back about 40 years. Let me explain again what you need for these studies. You need companies that issue shares to the market, and actually the SEC allows this as an outlet. You can issue shares to the market without going through the traditional issuance process, but in return, these shares cannot be traded. It used to be 2 years after they were issued. So let's say you're a public company, you have 1 million shares trading at $10 per share. First, and you decide to make a restricted stock offering of 200,000 shares. Hey, you're going to be the buyer of these shares. What's the condition? You buy these 200,000 shares, even though it's a public company, you will not be allowed to trade these shares for the next 2 years. Remember, the stock price is $10. Would you pay $10 for these shares? I certainly wouldn't. I mean, if you don't let me trade for 2 years. So what you have in these studies, you can observe the price at which these restricted shares are traded, and you can observe the discount. And what these studies find are huge discounts on these offerings, 25, 30, 35%. We'll come back and talk about why. So basically, you're able to get shares that trade at $10 for $6.50, but in return, you can't trade for the next 2 years. That seems like an incredibly large discount for 2 years of liquidity. Now, for most of these studies, let's report the average and the median. It's almost like they were in the 1960s and some forgot to take their statistics classes. They just stopped. But about 30 years ago, Bill Silber, who used to, I mean, you know, I don't think any of you have taken foundations from him, but Bill was a legend at Stern. I mean, he taught foundation for going back 40 years. And he actually did a study that he laughs about still because it's his most referenced and quoted study, where he took restricted stocks and he took the discount in each one. And then he asked, why are discounts different? Because not all of the restricted stocks had a 35% discount. Some had a 15, some had a 50, some had a 35. So he looked to see why there were differences, and he threw in a few variables. He threw in the level of revenues, hypothesizing that large revenue companies should have smaller discounts. He threw in the percentage of how big the block was relative to shares, arguing that the bigger the block, the bigger the discount should be. He threw in a dummy variable for earnings. The earnings were positive, it was 1, 0, it was negative, arguing that companies that are making money should have smaller discounts. And finally, he threw in a dummy variable for whether the person buying the shares had a customer relationship, in which case you might have some side game going on. He ran the regression, so you see the results of the study. So basically, the left-hand side is 1 minus the discount. It's essentially what percentage of the market price did you get on the restricted share. So the way to read these coefficients, the larger this coefficient, the smaller the discount. So basically, it's a 0.03. So companies with high revenues have smaller discounts than companies with low revenues. The larger the block, the larger the discount. Money-making companies have smaller discounts. And basically, he came up with the equation. He's saying, well, how does that help me? I've actually used the Silber equation to kind of finesse that restricted stock result. Remember, the average restricted stock has a 25% discount? I said, but given the Silber study, if your revenues are larger, that discount should be smaller. So I used the coefficient on revenue. So in the previous page, see this coefficient? And actually computed what would happen to a 25% discount if your revenues were a 500,000. or half a billion. With a half a billion revenues, your discount becomes, if you're a money-making company, less about 16 or 17%. So I'm staying within the restricted stock study universe, but I'm adjusting the discount for the fact that the larger your revenues, the smaller the discount should be. You're saying, why are there two columns? I also looked at money losing versus money making companies. A money making company with a half a billion in revenue should have a discount of about 17%. A money losing company with about 5 million in revenue should have a discount closer to 35%. What I'm arguing for is let's not use the 25% discount for every company because it should be different across companies. And the silver study gives me a way of quantifying the discount, but I'm still staying within the restricted stock universe. I also talked about IPO discounts. And I'll be quite honest, I don't believe these studies. Because here's what these studies show, that 2 months before an IPO, where you expect the IPO price to be $10, you will sell your equity stake for $6 or $7, because that's how big the discount is, 30%, 40%, 50%. You say, why would somebody sell their equity stake just for, you know there's an IPO coming in 3 months. Do you value liquidity? It doesn't seem to me that this can be liquidity alone. There's something else going on. In fact, I think both the restricted stock studies and IPO studies have a fatal problem. It's a sampling problem. There's a sampling bias. Let me explain. Remember I described what a restricted stock issue is? You're issuing shares at a big discount in the market price. And you're doing it because you don't want to go through the prospectus and the filing process and the oversight that comes with it. Think of what kinds of companies will ever issue restricted stock. It's not going to be a healthy, growing, well-managed company. It's going to be a basket case. So when you look at restricted stock studies, you actually have basket case companies in your sample. And not surprisingly, the discount is huge. With IPOs, you have a different bias. Let me ask you a question. Does every company that, and because these studies are based on actual IPOs and then working backwards for the 3 months prior and looking to see whether there are transactions. But does every company that announced an IPO actually carry it through? Not really. About 25 to 30% of companies that start the IPO process never complete. You know what the fatal flaw in the IPO studies is? They looked at the companies that actually went public. What should they have done? They should have looked at companies that actually announced they were going to go public and included those companies that never made it to the public phase. What will that do? That will reduce the discount dramatically because on those companies, you'd have actually got more than you'd have got by waiting. So there's a bias in both these studies that I think overestimates the liquidity discount. But you know what? Private company appraisers love big discounts. Think of why. Why do private company appraisers like to attach a big discount? What are the two contexts in which most private company valuations are done? They're not done for transactions, they're done for taxes or perhaps divorce court. Remember earlier in this class, we talked about bias. If you're valuing a company for taxes, you want as low a value as possible. And what you get here is that bias playing out. So let's pick the biggest discount. But I think they've set themselves up for a challenge. And about 10 years ago, the IRS finally stopped being cheap and actually spent the money to hire an expert witness who took the sampling problem aside. And he took the restricted stock studies and IPO studies. And after cleaning up for the sampling bias, he concluded that the liquidity discount was less than 10%, that you could not use the 25 to 30%. It was an eye opener for both courts and appraisers, because now you had a challenge. So I think we need to think about a different way of estimating liquidity than trusting restricted stock and IPO studies. So I'll give you a way. Remember I said every investment is illiquid, it's a continuum. There are no truly liquid investments. Even buying shares in Apple, you're not completely liquid because there is that bid-ask spread, which might be tiny, but it's still there. All I'm saying is with publicly traded stocks, you have an observable measure of liquidity. It's called the bid-ask spread. So about 15 or 20 years ago, and I've never had the energy to go back and revisit the study. It was actually end of 2000, actually tells you when. I got the bid-ask spread for every publicly traded company. I wish Capital IQ reported this. I would update it every year. And here's what I did. I took the bid-ask spread as a percentage of the stock price for every publicly traded stock. So think about it. I have 6,000 publicly traded stocks in the US. I take the bid-ask spread as a percent of the price. What does that tell me? It gives me a rough measure, the liquidity discount in each stock. And these are publicly traded stocks. I've put up their revenues, whether they're making money, how much cash they had, and how much their trading volume was, arguing that larger companies should have smaller liquidity discounts. Money-making companies should have smaller discounts. The more cash you have as a company, the smaller the discount should be because you already are liquid. And finally, the more you trade, the smaller the discount should be. That's my regression equation. He said, what are you going to do with this? Remember the restaurant that we just valued? I want to get an illiquidity discount. So here's what I did. I went in and plugged in the numbers for the restaurant. Basically, if you see the 0.2 is the $1.2 million in revenues. That's right there. It's a money-making company at about 5% cash as a percent of value. And it doesn't trade, so I put zero for the trading volume. I got a predicted bid-ask spread for the company or the restaurant of 12.8. What bid-ask spread for a restaurant? Think of that as your liquidity discount, given how publicly traded companies price illiquidity, that's how much of a discount I should ask for the restaurant. That's the number I ended up using, 12.88%. I tried the naive approach, the bludgeon approach, as I call it, with appraisers and just put the 25%, I get a much lower value. I even adjusted for their revenues and profits using the silver regression. I got a slightly higher discount, but with my bid-ask spread approach, the discount I get is 12.88%. I think that's a more reasonable discount than attaching this discount coming from restricted stock or IPO studies. Parrot?
The question is, wouldn't it be fair if you use like half of the bid-ask spread?
Half the bid-ask spread. The question is, do you want to cover both sides if you're the buyer? Basically, I think the illiquidity has to be to cover both sides. I know it sounds unfair, but I can see where you're going. We'll split the difference. Buyer takes half. The problem, I think, in private company transactions is the buyer makes the seller bear both sides of the cost up front. It might not be fair, but I think that's the way it works out. But I'm willing to listen to an argument that maybe half the spread should be all we use. But I think it's going to stay the spread until I can find sellers willing to take on half. Because the seller says it's your problem, right? And as a consequence, I'm ending up with both halves of the spread. Because think about, if you think about the total cost is the total spread. The question is who bears which half? In a typical publicly traded stock, the buyer bears half, the seller bears half. But if you think about somebody building this costing up front, I think the whole spread has to be built.
Understood. Thank you.
So that's a private to private transaction. It is the messiest because you got to deal with the diversification of the total beta and the liquidity with an illiquidity discount and two separate issues, right? You lack of diversification and liquidity might go together, but you have to deal with both separately. Let's move to a second scenario. Are there any other questions on private to private transactions?
When you did the regression for bid-ask right. spread, the independent variables were the same as the silver regression, is that correct?
No, the silver regression was an actual discount on the restricted stock issue, right? It's a difference in the restricted stock price and the actual market price. This was just the spread in the marketplace. Right? But it's similar. It's like a discount for public companies. The logic is the bid-ask spread is the liquidity discount for a public company. So I'm using the same logic, but the measure that I'm using is the actual bid-ask spread. Silver's regression was based upon the difference between the market price and the restricted stock price.
But on the independent variable side,
I'm using the similar logic there.
Another quick question.
Yep.
I think you mentioned that restricted stock are mostly issued by public companies that are a little bit wonky, but aren't.
Remember, 90% of restricted stock at public companies is employee restricted stock, which is not the restricted stock we're talking about here. Actually restricted stock issued to the public marketplace.
How does that work? I'm not even familiar
with that. Well, it's a very special clause. Very few companies use it. There are only about 40 companies every year that actually do this. That's why these samples tend to be really small.
Got
they
it.
Tend to be really small companies in lots of trouble. and they go to the SEC and they say, look, we'd like to use that restricted stock clause that allows us to issue shares without going through the hoops you've got to jump to make a tradition, because we need the money quickly. But in return, they end up leaving a lot of money on the table, because the people who buy those restricted shares then get this hefty discount.
Okay, got it. So employee RSU is totally different thing. We're talking totally about different. Like a rare SEC bypass to exactly. The public market.
This is a public market restricted stock issue. Because okay. The problem with employee RSUs is they're not traded. So you can't even see what they would be traded at. Interestingly, there are marketplaces opening for restricted stock trading. It's actually very dicey because the companies don't like it because they want the stock to be restricted until you vest. But they're opening up. So maybe you'll be able to observe illiquidity discounts in those markets.
Got it. Cool. Thank you.
So let's move to a second scenario. Private company, but you're now trying to sell to a publicly traded company. Let's take the restaurant example. Let's say the chef, instead of trying to sell to an investment banker, is going to sell to ARC Restaurants, a publicly traded restaurant chain. Two things are going to happen. One is, because the buyers of the publicly traded company should be diversified, you no longer have to use a total beta. So you can go back to using a market beta. So don't automatically use a total beta just because you're valuing a private company. The private company is selling to a public company, it's a buyer's perspective that matters, and buyers are diversified, you should go to a market beta. And second, once this company is acquired by the public company, liquidity is no longer an issue because the public company investors can sell their shares if they need liquidity. So I should have no liquidity discount. You know what? My public company valuation, my valuation for sale to a public company will look like any of the valuations we've done in this class earlier on public companies. I use a market beta, which gives me a lower cost of equity and a lower cost of capital. And I do a traditional valuation without the illiquidity discount. So the numbers look pretty much the same, but I have no illiquidity discount and I use a market beta. The value that I get for the equity is about 1.48 million. In contrast, when I did that private company valuation and just for liquidity, I got 454,000. What's the lesson you get out of this if you own a private business? You want to sell it. What's the biggest single thing you can do to increase your sale value?
Sell it to a public company.
Find a better buyer, right? I mean, you might not always have the choice of a public company, but let's face it, public and private are the two extremes. A private equity investor is not as undiversified as that investment banker, but not as diversified as a public. So what's happened in the last few years is the middle space is starting to get filled up. It's not just private versus public. You know, a private equity, you've got VCs in the middle there. So you can argue that there are these intermediate stops where you could actually not, you know, so you're getting, because as a private company seller, you don't want your buyer to be completely undiversified and demand a huge and a big chunk of your value for liquidity. But for a long time, you had no choice in some businesses. Now those choices are starting to open up, which means you will end up somewhere between the 454 and the 1,481. In fact, let's take those two numbers. 454,000 is what you'd have got with a private-to-private valuation. Let's say your potential buyer is ARC Restaurants. The value is 1.484 million. What do you think you're going to get as the chef? Where in that range are you going to end up? Do you think you're going to end up closer to 454,000? Or closer to 1.484 million, what will that depend on? So you have a potential public buyer, but don't assume the public buyer is going to offer you 1.484 million. If I were the public buyer, you know what I'm going to offer you, right? I'm going to offer you 456,000. And I want to act all generous. Look, I'm paying 2,000 more than you could have got. Yeah? Gabe says, ask for 2 million. Nice try, Gabe. But obviously, you're going to ask for 2 million. But remember, the worst thing that can happen is your one potential public buyer walks out of the room and you're stuck with an investment banker to sell it to. I think the reality is that you're going to end up in the middle and the power is going to rest with the public company buyer. I hate to say this, but you're probably going to end up closer to 550 or 600,000, higher than you'd have got by selling to a private buyer, but well below the 1.484 million. In fact, later on when we talk about M&A, I'm going to talk about the sad story of value destruction M&A, but there's one bright light. One group of M&A transactions where there is the potential for value creation. You know what that is? Public companies buying private businesses and rolling up. In fact, there are some public companies that are created by rolling up private businesses. It remains the one bright spot. You can see why that can happen, because you pay a premium over what the private buyer thinks is his value, but a discount on what you actually get as value. You're essentially taking advantage of your diversified investor base to go out and pay more than the private buyer thinks he can get, but less than what you get out of this. Now, Shashanka says, wouldn't it depend on how many public buyers? That's absolutely true. If you can get two public buyers, you're off to the races, because you play them off against each other and you'll end up at 1.484 million. That's absolutely true. And if you get a private equity or a VC guy in the middle, it might allow her a transition where you can get more than one buyer. So I think that those are all factors at play, but here's what I would do. If I am the analyst advising this private buyer, I would do the private to private value and put in my left pocket, 454,000. I'd do the private to public value, put in my right pocket. Remember which pocket I put what number in. And remember that those would be your reservation prices, the price at which you walk away from a transaction and the price at which you jump at the transaction. So I think you almost have to do both valuations, because they'll give you the extreme values, but you'll have to do both if you're asked to, value a private business. And Darshan says he's going to ask for a control premium. You're playing the game right? As a potential seller, if you have greedy buyers, play them off, right? So any questions on private to public valuation?
Sir, I had a question just what you previously said about the roll-up. Do you have any, if you were valuing a company, let's say, that had committed, call it a tech company, could be anywhere, and they were saying, we're going to acquire products for our platform over the next 5 years.
Yeah.
You either go two routes, do you? You either punch those businesses in, try to figure out some sort of rough proxy of what, excess capital they're going to bet for, what the earnings are, or you just leave it out.
Yeah, I think all they've said is so loose that you really don't know, because if I don't know the price you're going to pay and what you're buying, I don't even know that it's going to be value adding, value destroying, value neutral. But in a sense, we implicitly already do that, right? Because when you put a reinvestment rate and a return on capital and you come up with the growth and value in the future, you're implicitly assuming some degree of value creation that you've extrapolated from the past. We already do this. It's probably not worth doing in detail unless you have a very specific acquisition in mind. But I think that in general, in all valuation, we make assumptions about the future and what our managers are going to do in terms of those acquisitions in the reinvestment and growth assumptions we make in the DCF.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Now let's do one final, the third scenario. Private company for an initial public offer. Well, this should be pretty straightforward, right? Initial public offering, you're going to be a public company. There's no total beta talk. It's going to be market beta, because investors, if they choose not to be diversified, that's their problem. But there are also implications. Will the company change after it becomes public? There's disclosure requirements that are going to come with it, accounting changes that come with it. So let's talk about some of the issues. And I'm going to use Twitter from October 5th of 2013. This was about 3 weeks before Twitter's IPO. I did a DCF valuation of Twitter. And if you look at this DCF valuation, it looks like my valuation of any other public company. I use a market beta. And of course, this beta doesn't come from a regression, but since it never does in my valuation, it's not a big deal. I based it on 90% advertising, 10% information services, the two businesses they were in. I used an implied equity risk premium at that time. 75% of the revenues were from the US, 25% from the rest of the world. And I built up to a value. So let me hold on here. Let's suppose I've come up with the value of operating assets, discounting free cash flow of the firm at the cost of capital. So I've done exactly what I've done with any other public company. In fact, last year, as I was valuing IPOs, the first step in the process, projecting free cash flows, coming up with the cost of capital, I do exactly what I do with any other public company. So you might say, what's different about an IPO? Here are the twists you have to be careful about in an IPO. The first is when you do an initial public offering, not only are you opening yourself up to the public as a company, you're also raising capital on that opening day. In other words, you actually issue shares to the market and you're raising capital. So cash comes into the company. I need to know what you do with the cash before I finish my valuation. I'll explain that in a moment. Because there are three things you can do with the cash. The first is you can allow existing owners to cash out. That's what Spotify did in its IPO. Is the proceeds, now didn't stay with the company, they just left the company. The second is you can use the cash to pay down debt if you've taken on debt as a private company, you don't want the debt. Or the third is you can keep the cash in the company. 9 times out of 10 in IPOs, it's a third scenario that plays out. So when Peloton made its IPO, the cash it got in the IPO stayed in the company as a cash balance. Now, what I do with that cash is going to vary depending on which of those three scenarios plays out. The second thing that I have to deal with is when companies first go public, they have a boatload of securities they've issued along the way that are very different. I'll give you an example. When Facebook went public, it had 9 classes of preferred stock. You say, why? Most of these were convertible preferred stock. It turns out that every time they had a VC round, they issued a different kind of equity security. So you might have multiple classes of equity and you got to talk about what to do with each of them. In terms of the pricing issues, here are the questions. You can value an IPO and you can dance around the value as much as you want, but an IPO is a pricing. You're pricing it and the market has to buy that price. So it's a pricing issue. And the pricing is often done by investment bankers who offer you a pricing guarantee, an underwriting pricing guarantee. So what does that mean? The banker says, I will deliver $20 per share guarantee. But the problem with guaranteeing the $20 is if you cannot sell at the $20, the banker has to come up with the extra money to cover the difference, and bankers don't have that much capital. So you know what bankers do. Routinely, they discount the value on their IPO value because that's the only way you can get the offering through. So somewhere in the valuation, we've got to deal with these. So here's what I'm going to do. On the use of the proceeds, as I said, there are 3 things you can do. You can take it out of the firm, you can use it to pay down debt, or you can hold it as cash. If it's taken out of the firm, just ignore it because the cash will come and it'll go. It's not your problem. It's existing owners cashing out. If it's used to pay down debt, adjust your debt ratio, your cost of capital going forward because that debt's no longer going to be there. And if it's held as cash, just add the cash on to your cash balance. So you know what? The day that Alibaba did its IPO, it brought in $12 billion in cash. It went into its cash balance. It might seem like easy money. But the reason you need to add it onto your cash balance is that cash is basically going to, so when you did your free cash flow of the firm, you had those negative cash flows in years 1, 2, and 3 as a young company. This cash can cover that those negative cash flows. So if held as cash, just add it onto your cash balance. And if you look at my Twitter valuation, the IPO proceeds of $1 billion, so this is actually the offering date IPO, gets added onto the cash balance and increases the value of the company. We pause there. So when you have an IPO, check the prospectus because the prospectus should always tell you what the company will do with the cash. The Twitter prospectus, for instance, they were very clear they wanted to raise about $1 billion in cash. And they were also very clear they were going to hold on to the cash. So if you're going to do something else with the cash, you have to be explicit in the prospectus. It's required. So check for that in the prospectus because what you do with that billion in the valuation will depend on what will happen to the proceeds. In fact, in this example, if they told you that the billion was going to leave and existing owners were going to cash out, whoever the VCs were going to cash out, then I wouldn't have added the $1 billion because they'd have cashed out, the cash would have left the company. It's because it stays in the company that I'm adding it on. Any questions on dealing with cash?
Yeah, quick question.
Awesome.
He can go first.
My question. Thanks, Tina. My question is about actually, sir, if you think about companies today and they have committed to a secondary offering of issuing, more of the outstanding, what is sort of the textbook approach to that?
Well, are you talking about, the companies, for instance, I think it was, who was it that announced? Shake Shack, I think, announced it's going to issue equity, raise 50. Are you talking about something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I guess equity financing.
Remember, the effect of a new security offering on your DCF is neutral because we issue that those shares at a fair market price, nothing happens. Your cash balance will increase by 15 million or whatever they raise. Your share count will increase by however many shares they issue. The problem is if you issue the shares at a big discount. That's why restricted stock issues are so painful. Right? So by itself, that doesn't change my valuation of Shake Shack. It does mean that if I'm worried about distress at Shake Shack and I'm discounting the value, remember that failure probability, that this cash infusion might reduce that failure probability. So Boeing announces they're going to raise $15 billion in equity. Now, that will have consequences for my cash balance, my share count, but it might also bring down that 20% chance of failure I have for Boeing to a smaller number. Javi asks, will the proceeds be on the balance sheet right after the IPO? Yes, that's why cash balances balloon out after IPOs, because all that cash goes into the cash balance. Keenan, you had a question too?
Yeah, you said if the cash is held for reinvestment after the IPO, add the cash proceeds.
Yeah.
How exactly are you adding them? Are you just adding them to?
Just add it to cash balance. So this, you know how you do DCF, you come up with the value, then you add cash, you subtract out debt.
Yep.
You increase your cash balance by the amount of the proceeds.
Because it's presumed to be operational.
It's going to be there, right? After the IPO, it's when people talk about pre-money and post-money. This is the post-money. The pre-money is before the cash comes in. Post-money is where the proceeds are added.
Right. Yeah, just because you're keeping the cash. Okay, I get it. Yeah. Thank you.
Now, if you have claims from prior equity investors, don't reinvent again. If those claims are options, put them in the option. One of the things I have trouble with in IPOs is you see share counts used on Wall Street and by analysts that actually have no meaning. They won't count restricted stock issue. I don't know why. So don't trust the share counts you see for these stocks. With Peloton, for instance, I think analysts were using the actual shares shown on the balance sheet, when in fact this company had almost 25% more restricted stock units. Those are like regular shares and options outstanding. So you've got to count in restricted stock units in your share count. And if you have options, value them as options, subtract them out, do what we did with any company that has options. Any questions on the share count? Because to me, it's slippery. So take a prospectus check. Julieta?
Yeah, I do have a question. Doesn't this change whether it is a primary or secondary IPO?
What is a secondary IPO? No secondary IPO. There's a secondary offering. You can't have an IPO. Secondary offerings are neutral. It's very different, right? Because secondary offerings, as in the case of Shake Shack, you'll have cash come and share count increase. That's there. The question is, are you selling at a fair price? If you're selling at a fair price, there's no effect on that. So
was more on like whether new shares are being issued or existing shares are being IPO.
But there's no existing shares. You can't make a secondary offering with existing shares.
Gotcha. Okay.
Right? Because with existing shares, somebody owns them. That'll just be a transaction between one group and another. So you might be talking about authorized shares, which is kind of a meaningless number these companies tout. If you're making a secondary offering, your share count will increase. It's almost by definition.
Okay, thank you.
On her point, what is it called when existing private shareholders sell their shares into the market? Is that
a trade? Right? It's got nothing. Your value can't change if owner A sells to owner B or owner B sells to owner C, right?
Isn't there a name for a second? Is there like a hybrid follow-on where there's some new shares are issued and some existing private shares are sold?
Private shares that are sold, the bottom line is if some of the shares that are being sold is an owner cashing out, just ignore it. There's no effect on value. Somebody's right. Selling in. No, it's an ownership difference.
Yeah.
It might have a corporate governance effect, but it's not going to affect your value per share. It's only share count increases and cash balances that go up. Because if that owner is selling the shares, that money's not going to the cash balance. It's going to that owner. So that's why you can ignore it, because it's like a side transaction. The fact that the company might act as a middleman in this transaction is neither here nor there. You can ignore it.
Cool.
So when I did my Twitter evaluation, here's what it looked like. there were seven classes of convertible and preferred because it had seven VC rounds. They had 86 million restricted stock units, 44.16 million options, and they just agreed to buy a company with 14.79 million shares. So I included the RSUs, I included the new shares they're going to issue on the acquisition, but I did not include the options. The options are valued separately as options by using the option pricing models. So my share count, 574.44, was about 50 million higher than what bankers and analysts were using. But I can't ignore RSUs. They're out there, they're shares. The fact that they're not counted by the company doesn't make them go away. So my suggestion is check through your share count to make sure you are on the right track. Okay. Now let's talk about the investment banking guarantee. The investment bankers guarantee the price, and because they guarantee the price, there's an incentive on the banker's part to discount the price. In fact, studies consistently show that the discount that you get on the price, on the offering, on is about 15%. These studies just look at what happens to stock price on the offering day. That might sound unfair to the issuing company that the bankers are discounting, but in most cases, the issuing company goes along for a simple reason. It acts almost like a commercial for the company, right? Because what does a Wall Street Journal report the day after your offering? Stock price jumps 25% on offering. So while people make a big deal about this in academic finance, they call it the IPO puzzle. I don't think there's any puzzle. The structure of an IPO will lead to underpricing. In fact, it's one reason why Bill Gurley and other VCs are arguing that maybe we need to change the process, that maybe we need to think about direct listing. Because, and bankers say, we provide a service, we value the company. Come on, do you really think bankers value the company? They price the company, they don't even do that very well. I mean, look at WeWork, right? So I think the more you look at what bankers add in value to an IPO, the more you have to think about direct listing as a very legitimate alternative. It might not be for every company, but if you're a high profile company, and if you're at Uber, why the heck do you need a banker to do a roadshow and a pricing? You've been priced multiple times by different VCs, you know? And I think that increasingly we need to think about a different way of making public offerings.
Can I ask a quick question about the process?
Yeah.
I don't know everything about it, but my impression was the bank tries to come up with a value for the shares before the IPO.
Price.
Yep. They try to come up with a price for the shares. They're generally going to put the target price for the IPO lower, so the shares will go up. And if they back it as the underwriter, I thought that the price guarantee was usually what they expected the IPO price to be, and you were just stabilizing to keep it roughly in that.
No, they want the price to jump. If you set it at the expected price, you'd see a lot more bankers having to come up with capital. For a banker, it's almost a disaster when an IPO on the offering day drops from the offering price.
Got it. So if they're setting the share price at like 25 and they're doing a firm offering, they might be stabilizing it up to 30 or 35.
And stabilizing, you can do only so much, right? It's not like the old days. The IPO is a $3 billion. I mean, you take an Uber, it's a $60 billion company. What investment bank has the capital to stabilize the price if the market really doesn't want to pay $60 billion? So in a sense, if you're stabilizing prices, you've already lost the game.
Right.
And you got to hope and pray you can get out of this game alive. So it's a strange process. And when I talked about the reason I keep emphasizing the word pricing is IPOs are pricing game. In fact, if I were pricing Twitter, remember that example we had about how much the market is paying per user? The pricing, I would say, would be based on what the market is pricing companies at, which is users. And based on the 240 million users that Twitter has, the pricing I would get would be a very different number. Your job as a banker is to price things, and not surprisingly, they put that discount on the price. And this is this is from the studies that actually look at how much of a discount there is. You know, so you look at IPO proceeds, the on the offering day, what the return is. That, think of that as the underpricing. On very small IPOs, that underpricing is 16%. As the IPOs get bigger, the underpricing tends to be on average less. It's about 8% for half a billion or more. But you can see a huge variance in these numbers. And you saw that, take a look at just last year at what happened in the opening day. In fact, last year was a bad year for bankers for a simple reason. The price didn't jump very much in the offering day. And when it did, it didn't stay high for very long. But you know, that was an unusual year. Most years you get a pretty hefty payoff on that day, but it's not free money. Investors are not going to be able to exploit it. In fact, let me ask you a question. Why could you not create an investment strategy of buying IPOs at the offering price? Because after all, if they're under price, all you have to do is get the shares at the offering price and turn around and flip it, right? At the end of the offering day. Why is it and people have tried this, but it's never seemed to deliver the kind of returns that you see on paper. Why might that be? Why does this strategy not work? You know what I mean by this, right? Take every IPO, ask for 1,000 shares in every IPO at the offering price. And given the study, you should make about a 15% return in a day.
You don't get a choice on allocation. So it depends a lot on the relationships with the bank of whether
so one is this client relationship. You got to be the special client and they're doing it. So that's true. You know, the other is you ask for 1,000 shares in every IPO. Do you get 1,000 shares in every company you ask for? No, you get 500 in some, 300 in some, 1,000 in others. You know what ends up happening is you get 1,000 shares in all the IPOs that you don't want to get 1,000 shares in. And you get 100 shares in the IPOs that are truly underpriced because it's demand and supply. So what you end up with in your portfolio is a very skewed portfolio, a portfolio that's skewed towards overpriced IPOs. That's always been the weakness in IPO-based investment strategies, is you're not getting the IPOs you want to get the IPO in. One final point, and I talked about why the underpricing. You know, if 100% of Twitter had been offered on the opening day, and Twitter was the stock where I think the offering price was set at 27, but the stock opened at 45. That's a huge jump. Think about offering 100% of your shares. If you're Twitter, you offer 100% of your shares at 27 and the price jumps to 45, you're going to be really pissed off. Why? Because you've left $18 on the table for the first investors in your stock. But if only 10% of your shares are being offered on that offering day, you can see very quickly why companies are okay with the underpricing. And here's why. Other VCs are lined up, because remember, there's a period for which VCs and insiders are not allowed to sell their shares. They want the stock to look good 6 months, a year from now. What they're hoping for is the glow from the IPO, the offering day, will continue for a long enough time period that they'll be able to sell their shares at that higher price. Might not always work out, but part of the reason I think you don't see the pushback you get and you would expect from issuing companies is for that reason. One final example, and then we'll end this packet. I mean, so far I've talked about private to private, private to public, private to IPO. Let's talk about private to venture capital to public offering. You have a startup, let's say you're a private owner. You're the only person supplying equity. You're completely undiversified. Well, remember, we use a total beta based on your R squared. I mean, because you're completely undiversified, I'm going to use the market, the correlation of that sector. So you have a total beta of 4 and your cost of equity is 24%. But based on your own expectations, 2 years from now, you expect venture capitalists to provide you money. That in venture capitalists is a little more diversified than you. The way this shows up is their correlation with the market of their portfolio. So the VC's portfolio is 0.5, not 0.25. So the total beta that they use is 2, and the cost of equity is 14%. And your expectation is 5 years from now, you plan to go public. And if you go public, there is, of course, investors should be diversified. You can use the market beta. What I'm saying is, even if no risk in your company is changing, given who's pricing your company, you should expect your cost of equity to go down. And basically, if you see this valuation, that's what I've done. For the first 2 years, I used a cost of equity based on the total beta of a completely undiversified investor, you. For the next 3 years, I've used the beta and cost of equity of a VC. So it's lower than your cost of equity. And for my terminal value, I've used the market beta. So the terminal value is driven by my market beta, and I'm back into my value today with different costs of equity. I think we need to do this more with young private startups, is rather than just go to an extremely high number or an extremely low number. For instance, if I'd used the market beta all the way through, I'd have overvalued the company, you know, 2,165 million. If I used the 24% as my cost of equity all the way through, I'd have undervalued the company. But if I use cost of equity as a change over time, I've come up with a Goldilocks value, just the right number. So before I sign off, any final questions? So take a look at that. Again, not rocket science, but with private companies, context matters. You got to tell me who you're going to sell it to, because the value that you'll be willing to pay will vary depending on the potential buyer, because your cost of equity can change given how diversified or undiversified that buyer is. Perry?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Isn't this very similar to how we were discussing that when you are valuing a company, you should use the tax rates and the cost of capital of the target and not the acquirer, because then you'll be transferring the benefit of being a large acquirer?
I'm not breaking that rule, right? What am I doing? What's the beta? It's still the beta of the company. All I'm saying is the risk of the company is not changing, but the buyer's perspective on that risk or what he sees depends on how diversified or undiversified it is. So I'm staying with the same principle of the risk comes from the business the company's in. But I'm saying the kind of cost of equity I will demand as an investor will depend on how diversified or undiversified I am. So I think I'm staying consistent to that rule of, hey, look at the target company. Your risk should come from the target company's risk. I'm not violating that rule. Yeah. I'm just saying that from the perspective of an evolving company where the ownership of the marginal investor is shifting over time, your cost of equity could change.
I'll try to think this. Still a little confused, but I'll get back.
So I'm not using some other company's beta or a beta of a buyer who's safe or risky. I'm just saying in this case, the business is the business. The risk is the same. The market beta, the beta of the business hasn't changed, but your perspective as an investor could alter the cost of equity.
So the value of the company is changing, right? Let us say, yeah. I as an individual go to buy this Italian restaurant versus we have Heston Blumenthal.
Do you know what will happen over time? What's the end game here?
Like everybody should be paying the least possible value, right? No.
I'm sorry?
Everybody should be paying, like valuing the company at one rate, irrespective of who the buyer is.
That's, and in a sense, who's going to be the person paying the highest price? It's going to be the public company. So if you're caught up in an auction, the end game here is, if this is true over time, investment should go from private to public. Private businesses will get pushed out by public companies. And that's already happening. In sector after sector, public companies get, private companies get pushed out by public companies because an undiversified investor will drop out of the auction. There's only one price in an auction. And if this is an auction, over time, the publicly traded investors are going to end up winning out. So you're right. Ultimately, there's only one price. That price is the price to the bidder who is most diversified here. And investors who are not diversified get pushed out of the game. This is actually happening in the PE and the VC space. The old days used to have sector-specific PEs and VCs. They're getting pushed out by the KKRs and Blackstones of the world. Because KKR and Blackstone can afford to pay a much higher price for the same business than those VCs and PEs.
Interesting. Thank you.
So if you're saying the number of public companies decreasing, that might be true, but it's not decreasing by as much as some of the legend would have you believe, but the size of the public companies at stake is also increasing. And you didn't have $1 trillion companies until two years ago. And now you have 4, now even with the crisis.
Professor, I have a question. So wouldn't one of the implications of this be, even if you were like a private business owner, say you were accumulating wealth, that it would make more sense for you to kind of diversify into like other private businesses just to kind of continue to
learn? Yeah, that's actually true. In fact, my advice to private business owners is, as you say, at some point you have to start extracting money out of a private business and building a 401k on the side, which is invested in ETFs and index funds. If nothing else, that's one way in which you can reduce this diversification factor, right? Is by having other wealth that's invested in other asset classes. It's a very simple intuitive rationale. If you put all your eggs in one basket, even if you're a wealthy person, that's a lot of unnecessary risk that you're not getting rewarded for. But the other, what's the other reason people run private businesses? They get emotional dividends, right? It's your business, you built it up, you feel good about it. So maybe the emotional dividends are large enough that they compensate for the fact that you're taking a lot of risk for which you don't get a return.
Thank you.
Hey, Professor, when you say like IPOs are pricing and not valuations, yeah. Do investment banks not run any DCF at all, even though?
They run DCFs that reverse engineer into a price. Why? Because I don't know why they do it. In fact, I've argued that they should stop doing DCFs because they do a terrible job because they're trying to back into a price. So here's how it works. You're told, you know, I think this company should be trading at 10 times revenues. Now let's see if we can make our DCF deliver that number. Why 10 times revenues? Because that's pretty close to what the last VC round went at. I mean, remember the reason Goldman used a $65 billion valuation or pricing for WeWork was they said SoftBank paid $47 billion. SoftBank's a smart investor, so they must have got a good deal. So let's use a 20. So it's almost reverse engineered in that sense. We have VC pricing numbers, so you have a sense of what the base should be based on the pricing, and then you build up on that number. And then you do a DCF to kind of reverse engineer that number. It's a cynical view of the world, but I think if you go work in IPO spaces, you'll very quickly realize how much of this is reverse engineered. So why waste your time and energy on a DCF if you don't mean it, right?
And the end goal is to get to a price which can get you like 10, 15%
pump. In fact, I think it's a pricing mission. So I don't fault bankers for pricing. What I fault them for is playing this game of I did a DCF valuation and that's why they stop. You did a pricing, just call it a pricing. Let's move on. We'd have a much more honest discussion if that were the case.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Professor, until what slide do we have to study for the quiz?
This one.
Okay, cool.
Okay, so no other questions? Shashanka, you had a question?
So just curious about Facebook IPO. I remember that was one of the ones that did go very well. So was it just like it was...
I think that what happened was that pricing is a mood game, right? It's mood and momentum. And I think that Morgan Stanley, which is the lead investment banker for Facebook, and Facebook was so convinced that they could pull anything off that they did, you know, that they really took it for granted. They essentially assumed that investors could, so they repriced. In fact, they kept repricing the IPO, the 24 hours, 12 hours. It's almost like they were saying, look, we know we can take advantage of you, so we are. And I think the danger with not paying some respect for investors is that they see through it. So I think that that's what went wrong in that IPO is at least you got to maintain the facade of, you know, it's all about investors. We want to sell you a company at a fair price. I mean, no, they didn't even try.
So did they just keep increasing the price?
They kept increasing the price and they made it very clear that this has nothing to do with value. So there's a reason you play the value game, even though you don't mean it, is you got to tell people you're getting good value for this price. They didn't even bother. Go back and read actually the news stories leading into the Facebook IPO. It's just, you know, I couldn't believe what the bankers were doing in the roadshows, but you know, they just felt, you know, they felt that they could not lose.
Google did a different type of IPO or something like that, right?
I'm sorry?
Google did a different type of IPO, right?
No, like, Google was a traditional IPO. Google did an auction. So basically, it's very close to direct listing. They actually, so think of it, in a direct listing, what you do is you let demand and supply set the offering price. So there's no fixed offering price. You open for trading, there's demand, supply, the price gets set. Google did something similar. They did an auction to set their price, saying, we don't want bankers setting the price. We let demand, supply set the price. So that's pretty much what the direct listing approach will lead to as well. It's going to be pure demand and supply that sets the price.
Professor, in the case of VC ownership of a company, where it might not be as liquid. How do you account for that loss of, or that reduced liquidity in the valuation?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, because it's actually an accounting question now, because if you take a SoftBank and you look at their holding of Oyo, it is accountants now have to come in and estimate what Oyo is worth. And they don't usually attach an illiquidity discount. The argument is very simple, because VCs tend to hold shares in companies that are either going to go public or could be bought by other acquiring companies. The argument is the illiquidity discount is small enough, we can ignore it. But you can see that can get you into trouble if you run into a crisis where VC money dries up and you can't get out of positions. So I think it remains an open discussion when you do fair value accounting of these private holdings, whether you should attach an illiquidity discount. I think if you're in a market like this one, you have to start thinking about attaching discounts to those portfolios as well, because getting out of them is not going to be easy. So, but I think it's still an open question as to whether VC holdings should be discounted for illiquidity, because right now they're not.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're done for the day, and there are a couple of fun questions. Colin asks, is a direct listing riskier? You know, there's a post I have in direct listings. I'll send you that post on direct listings. I think there are, for some companies, they could be riskier. We're a really small company with no profile in the market. But if you're a larger company with a higher profile, what do you lose? No, I don't see how letting demand and supply set your price can be worse than having a banker set your price. Okay, so that's it. And I will send you information about the quiz and the timing. It will be open for about 12 hours like last time. And you have an hour to take it. It's 5 multiple choice questions. And let's see how it goes. Take care. Bye-bye.